white men of the patriarchy had stories to tell, and the future of theater was like the past of theater, creating innovation in storytelling, inverting narrative expectations. He smiled. So far, only he had had applause. They all looked at the girl, who shrugged, bit her fingernails.
"Don't know. Not a fortune teller," she said.
"Impact of technological age? We are in Silicon Valley, after all." Audience laughed. Warrior leapt in, kicking his dead horse. "With YouTube and MOOCs and all the other innovations, knowledge has been democratized." Looked at the girl, seeking alliance. "With feminism equalizing homework, women are given the freedom from childbearing and drudgery. A farmer's wife in Kansas, who once had to be only a housekeeper, who had to put up the fruit and wipe the bottoms and churn the butter, etc., could have half her workload shared and could go from wifey to creator. She could listen to the newest innovations on her computer. She could watch new plays from the comfort of her home. She could learn how to compose music all by herself. She could be the creator of a new Broadway show without ever having to live in the soulless third circle of hell that is New York City." Irritation bristled in Lancelot. Who was this one-note show-off, and what gave him the right to spit at the way other people chose to live their lives? Lancelot loved his circle of hell. "Let's not patronize the wives of the world, shall we?" he said. Laughter. "Sometimes people who create are so narcissistic, we assume that our way of living is the jewel in the crown of humanity. But most playwrights I know are asinine codpieces." Assenting roar from the codger. "And the wives are far better human beings. They are kinder, more generous, more worthy all around. There's a nobility in making life smooth and clean and comfortable. It's a choice at least equal to the choice of navel-gazing for a living. The wife is the dramaturge of the marriage, the one whose work is essential to what is produced, even if her contributions are never directly recognized. There is glory in this role. My wife, Mathilde, for instance, gave up her job years ago to make mine run more smoothly. She loves to cook and clean and edit my work. It makes her happy to do these things. And what piece of jerk chicken would condescend to say that she was lesser for not being the creator in the family?" He was pleased with how smoothly the words seemed to exit his mouth. He thanked the powers that be for his glibness. "Nothing to do with it." Tartly, from the girl playwright. "I have a wife, and I am a wife. I'm not comfortable with the gender essentialism I'm hearing here. I mean, of course, wife in the genderless sense of helpmeet," Lancelot said. "There are male wives. When I was an actor, I was so underemployed that I basically did all the housework myself, while Mathilde earned the dough." He did the dishes. That part was true. "Anyway, there is an essential difference in genders that isn't politically correct to mention these days. Women are the ones to bear the children, after all. They are the ones to nurse. They are the ones, traditionally, who care for the infants. That takes a huge amount of time." He smiled, waiting for the applause. But something had gone wrong. There was a cold silence from the crowd. Someone was talking in a loud voice at the back of the auditorium. What had he done? He looked down in panic at Mathilde, who was staring at her shoes. The girl playwright scowled at Lancelot and said, enunciating very crisply, "Did you just say that women aren't creative geniuses because they have babies?" "No," he said. "Goodness, no, not because. I wouldn't say that. I love women. And not all women have babies. My wife, for one. At least not yet. But listen, we're all given a finite amount of creativity, just like we're given a finite amount of life. And if a woman chooses to spend hers on creating actual life and not imaginary life, that's a glorious choice. When a woman has a baby, she's creating so much more than just a made-up world on the page. She's creating life itself, not just a simulacrum. No matter what Shakespeare did, it's so much less than your average illiterate woman of his age who had babies. Those babies were our ancestors, necessary to make everyone here today. And nobody could seriously argue that any play is worth a single human life.
I mean, the history of the stage supports me here. If women have historically demonstrated less creative genius than men, it's because they're making their creations internal, spending the energies on life itself. It's a kind of bodily genius. You can't tell me that that isn't at least as worthy as genius of imagination. I think we can all agree that women are just as good as men, better in many ways. But the reason for the disparity in creation is because women have turned their creative energies inward, not outward. The murmurs had turned angrier. He listened, astonished, and heard only a very small smattering of applause.
"What?" he said. The codger jumped in to agree, giving such a long, convoluted, self-regarding story that name-dropped Liam Neeson and Paul Newman and the Isle of Wight that Lancelot's cold sweat dried, and the pulse in his gut calmed down. He looked again for Mathilde, hoping to catch her eye and comfort himself in her, but where she had been sitting was an empty seat. There was an enormous crack in the world. Lancelot was teetering. Mathilde had left. Mathilde had stood and walked out of the auditorium publicly. Mathilde was so angry she'd had enough. Enough what? Forever enough? Maybe, when she emerged into the astringent light of Palo Alto, she felt the sun on her face and realized the truth, that she was far better off without him, that she, a saint, was only being dragged down for the dog croat of a husband he was. His hands itched to call her. For the rest of the discussion, the younger two panelists and the moderator declined to look at Lancelot, which was for the best anyway, because it took all his concentration to stay in his chair. He sat in his discomfort until the end, and when there was the meet and greet afterward, he said to the moderator, "I may skip the cheese and crackers just now. Don't want to get my head handed to me." And the moderator winced and said, "Might be a good call." Lancelot sped to the green room to look for Mathilde, but she wasn't there. And there was such a tsunami of people pouring out now into the hallway that he darted into a private handicapped bathroom to call her, but though her phone rang and rang, she didn't answer. He listened to the crowd noise outside intensify, then gradually diminish. He spent a long time looking at himself in the mirror, the forehead so huge he was wearing his own billboard, the strange nose that seemed to be growing as he aged, the fine hairs on the lobes of his ears an inch long when uncurled. All this time, and he'd been carrying around his ugliness as confidently as if it were beauty. How strange. He played a game of solitaire on his phone, then about 15 more games of solitaire, calling Mathilde between each. The phone made an ignominious bleep and died. His gut spoke to him, and he remembered he hadn't eaten since breakfast in the hotel in San Francisco, and that there was supposed to have been a lunch, and he thought of the usual bitter iced tea and chocolate tort for dessert, but his heart quailed, and as it was somewhere near 3 o'clock already, the lunch was long over. He poked his head out into the corridor, where there had been crowds milling when he went into the bathroom, but it was empty. He slid along the wall and poked his head around the corner to look, but the way to the front door was clear as well. He walked out and stood looking at the piazza where students with giant backpacks beetled on their way to world dominance. The wind felt lovely on his face.
"For shame," said a voice to his right, and he slid his eyes toward a woman, desiccated head covered thinly with dyed black hair. "To think I've always loved your work, too. I wouldn't have paid for a single ticket if I knew you were such a misogynist."
"I'm not a misogynist. I love women," Lotto said. And she snorted and said,
"That's what all misogynists say. You just love to pork women."
It was no use. He did love to pork women, even if he'd porked only one since matrimony. He sped away along the stucco wall, darting under the shadows and through the copses of eucalyptus, berries crunching underfoot, stepping out confusedly on a street called El Camino Real. He was feeling the opposite of royal. He took the road in the vague direction of San Francisco. He sweated through his shirt, the sun far hotter than he'd thought. The street was endless, and he was lightheaded. He wandered through a neighborhood with odd little split levels behind palatial gates, pink oleander,
cactus gardens. He came to another great road and crossed the street to a cafeteria-style Mexican restaurant, where surely he could buy some sustenance and get his druthers back, and he ate half of his chili relleno burrito while waiting in the line to pay. He was still chewing when he dug in his pocket for his wallet. With a leap of fear, he remembered he'd left it in the hotel room. He never had to pay for a thing on these jaunts, and if he did, Mathilde was there with her purse, and frankly, he hated the way wallets made his buttocks look as if they were sporting a huge canker. He preferred the sleek profile of the walletless rear. He shrugged at the cashier, whose eyes narrowed, who said something menacing in Spanish. He put the plate down and said, "I'm sorry, lo siento," until he backed all the way to the door. At last he found himself in a horseshoe-shaped strip mall, where, out of the corner of his eye, he saw something that made a flutter of astonishment in his chest. A telephone booth, the first he'd seen in, what, decades? He found himself dialing collect, the only number he still knew by heart in this age of cell phones. Such a relief, the weight of the receiver in the hand, the reek of others' breath and grease. His mother's voice rose on the other end. Collect? Oh dear, yes, she'd take it. And then she said,
"Lancelot? Darling? What's wrong? Is it that wife of yours? Gracious, has she left you?"
He swallowed. He felt a strange echo of having lived this moment before.
When?
College. Just after the Saturday marriage ceremony, when he ran up to his dorm, how small it had suddenly seemed, skim-coated with childhood. After he'd stuffed his clothes into a duffel for the stolen honeymoon on the Maine coast, he picked up the phone with suppressed glee and called his mother to tell her he was married.
"No, you're not," she'd said.
"I am. It's done," he'd said.
"Undo it. Quickie divorce," she'd said, and he'd said,
"No."
She'd said, "What kind of girl would marry you, Lancelot? Think, an immigrant? A gold digger?"
"Neither," he'd said. "A Mathilde Yoder, the best person on the planet. You'll love her."
"Won't," she'd said. "I'll never meet her. You get it annulled or you're disinherited. No more allowance. And how are you going to survive in the big bad city without money? How are you going to survive as an actor?" she'd said, and he'd smarted at the sneer. He'd thought of a life empty of Mathilde. He'd said, "I'd rather die." And she'd said, "My darling, you will eat your words." And he'd sighed and said, "I hope you and your tiny heart have a great life together, mother," and hung up. The wedge had been driven all the way in. He felt sharp now in the California sunlight, nauseated.
"What did you say?" he said.
"I'm truly sorry," his mother was saying. "I am. All those years I've bitten my tongue, darling. All the pain between us, all the distance, all of it unnecessary. That horrible creature. I knew she'd end up hurting you. Just come on home. Rachel and Elizabeth and the kids are here for a visit. Sally would leap the moon to baby you again. Come on home, and your women will take care of you."
"Oh," he said. "Thank you, but no."
"Sorry?" she said.
"I called because I lost my cell," he said. "I wanted to let Sally know in case Mathilde was frantically calling around for me. Tell her I'll be home soon with the champagne and cheese for the party," he said.
"Listen, darling,"
Antoinette began, but Lancelot said, "Bye," and she said,
"I love you,"
into the dead phone. Antoinette put down the receiver. No, she thought. He hadn't chosen that wife over his mother again. Not when Antoinette had given him everything. Without her, he would never have become what he was. He never would have written her into immortality the way she'd groomed him to do. Boys belong to their mothers. Cord cut decades ago, but they'll always share the warm, dark swim.
The ocean out the window cast its net of waves onto the white sand, withdrew it, catching nothing. Antoinette knew the little pink house on the dunes was listening, her sister-in-law rolling peanut butter cookies in the kitchen, her daughter and grandchildren just coming in from the beach, the outdoor shower spitting on below where she sat. Lord give her strength, but she was sick of these dark, small, fearful people. Surely it was natural she'd love them less than she loved her son, who was big and golden like her. Mice are nice, but lions roar. In the kitchen, Sally rolled dough in greasy palms, fretting. The phone had rung and Antoinette's voice had risen in her bedroom sharply.
"Is it that wife of yours?" she'd said.
Sally considered her sister-in-law. Though she appeared confected of sugar and air, there was a bitter black walnut at her core. Sally worried for Lancelot, poor child, whose sweetness went all the way through. She considered calling Mathilde to see what was going on, but refrained. Nothing is gained in the immediate. Her work was slow and at a distance. After some time, Antoinette stood, and with the movement she caught sight of her own face in the vanity mirror, wrinkled at the corners, exhausted, swollen. Well, no wonder. Such a force of effort it cost her to keep her son safe. The world more perilous by the moment, liable to disintegrate if she wasn't constantly vigilant. The things she had done for Lancelot, the sacrifices she'd made. She thought of a grand reveal when she was dead, the strings he'd never know she'd pulled until she was gone, the horrors she'd endured for his sake. Did she choose to plant herself here, in this shabby pink house? She did not. With the money Gawain left, she could have been bathing in luxury. Top floor of the Mandarin Oriental in Miami, room service in steel bands summoned at whim. Marble bathrooms the size of this shack. Sunlight like diamonds on the water below. But she wouldn't touch more of Gawain's money than she must to survive. It was all for her children, their shocked faces when they knew the extent of what she'd done. She brought the old comforting image before her again, so real that it was like a scene she'd watched in rerun on television. Her son, in a black suit. She hadn't seen him in decades. In her mind, he was still the gawky, pustuled child she'd let the North swallow up. His shirt threadbare, his wife all drab in cheap black, tartishly made up. Blue eyeshadow, brown lip liner, feathered hair, she imagined. Sally would hand him the envelope with the letter in which Antoinette had explained it all, everything she had done for him. He would turn away, choking, open it, read.
"No!"
he'd shout. And when his wife would touch his shoulder tentatively, he'd shake her off, bury his face in his hands, mourning all the years he neglected to be grateful to his mother. Rachel came down the hallway and saw Antoinette standing in her room. When Antoinette looked up into the mirror, she saw her daughter and slipped her smiling face over the stern one like a mask. Her teeth were still beautiful.
"I believe Sally made cookies for the little ones, Rachel," Antoinette said.
She moved her huge body through the door and down the hallway with painful slowness and sank into her chair.
"I don't think it will do much harm for me to taste one or two," she said, smiling coquettishly.
And Rachel found herself bowing with a plate of cookies in the same old subservient position. Only her brother could wind their mother up like so. God, Lotto. Now Rachel would have to spend the rest of the break appeasing the old beast, and the ancient resentment toward her brother came swiftly up out of the deep. The noble feel the same strong feelings as the rest of us. The difference is in how they choose to act. The urge to utter a few destructive words that would have let pandemonium into Lotto's world was quelled, locked in. She heard her children coming loudly up the stairs, took a breath, bent lower.
"Take a few more, Mother," she said,
and her mother said,
"Well, thank you, darling. Don't mind if I do."
It took Lancelot 20 minutes of standing in the shade under a bus stop listening to the nervous young people chittering around him to calm down after his call with his mother. Only when the bus sighed and knelt the passengers off like a carnival elephant did he remember that, without money, he couldn't even catch the BART. He imagined Mathilde, feeling sickly. His words redoubled to him, sounding venomous now. If he'd said a woman's creative genius went into her babies, what did it mean about Mathilde, a woman who had none? That she was lesser? Lesser than other women who did? Lesser than he was, who created? But he didn't think so, not at all. He knew she was better than everyone. He didn't deserve her. She had made it back to the Nob Hill Hotel, was packing, was stepping into a yellow taxi, was boarding a plane to fly away from him. The day had at last come. She was leaving him, and he would be left with nothing, bereft. How would he live without her? He had cooked, but had never scrubbed a toilet. He had never paid a bill. How would he write without her? The buried awareness of how completely her hands reached into his work. Don't look, Lotto. It'd be like looking at the sun. The sweat had dried on his shirt. He had to do something. He had to expend his energy somehow. It couldn't be more than 30 miles to the city. There was only one way there, straight north. It was a beautiful day. He had long legs and great endurance. He could walk fast, 5 miles an hour. He'd get to the hotel at about midnight. Perhaps she wouldn't have left yet. Maybe she wasn't so angry anymore. Maybe she had just gone to the spa for a massage and facial, and would order room service and watch a naughty movie and take her vengeance this way. Passive-aggressively. Her style. He set off, keeping the sun at his left, and drank water at a succession of dog parks. Not enough. He was thirsty. In the twilight, he passed the airport and smelled the salt marsh on the wind. The traffic was terrible, and he was nearly hit by a peloton of cyclists, 3 semi-trailers, and a man driving a Segway in the dark. As he walked, he chewed over what had happened at the panel. He saw it over and over and over again. After a few hours, it became a story, as if he were telling it at a bar to a band of friends. A few times through, and the imaginary friends at the bar had become tipsy and laughed at the story. With repetition, what had happened lost its power to wound him. It had become comical, no longer shameful. He was no misogynist. He could summon hundreds of women from the time before Mathilde to attest to his lack of misogyny. He was simply misunderstood. His fears of Mathilde's leaving him dulled under the friction of the story. An overreaction, and she would be ashamed of herself. She would be the one to apologize to him. She had proved her point. He'd give that to her. He didn't blame her. She loved him. He was an optimist at heart. All would be well. He came into the city and nearly wept with gratitude for the tighter blocks, for the sidewalks, for the streetlights gently leading him one to the next. His feet were bleeding. He could feel it. He was sunburnt, mouth dry, stomach knotted with hunger. He stank as if he'd taken a dip in a pond of sweat. He made a very halting way up the hill to the hotel and went in, and the desk clerk, who'd blessedly checked them in the day before, went, "Oop! Mr. Satterwhite, what happened?" And Lotto rasped, "I was mugged." Because in a way he was, the audience robbing him of his dignity. And the man summoned the bellhop, who brought the hotel's wheelchair, and Lotto was escorted up to his room in the elevator, and the key was produced, and he was pushed inside, and Mathilde sat up in bed, naked under the sheet, and smiled at him. "Oh, there you are, love," she said. Such magnificent self-possession. Really, she was a wonder of the world. The bellhop bowed his way out, murmuring something about complimentary room service in a moment.
"Water,"
Lotto croaked.
"Please."
Mathilde stood, put on her robe, and went to the bathroom and poured out a glass and brought it with extreme slowness to him. He drank it down in a single draft.
"Thank you. More, please,"
he said.
I'm happy to serve, she said, smiling broadly. She didn't move.
Em, he said.
Yes, my creative genius, she said.
No more punishment. I'm a dope unfit for human society. I wear my privilege like an invisible cloak and imagine it gives me superpowers. I deserve at least a day in the stocks and probably some rotten eggs heaved at my head. I'm sorry.
She sat on the edge of the bed and looked at him calmly. That would have been nicer if it had been sincere. You're arrogant.
I know, he said.
Your words have more weight than most people's. You swing them wildly, and you can hurt a lot of people, she said.
I only care that I hurt you, he said.
You assume so much about me. You don't get to speak for me. I don't belong to you, she said.
I'll stop doing anything that displeases you. Would you please, please, please bring me more water?
She sighed and brought him more, and there was a knock at the door, and she opened it, and there was the bellhop with a rolling table, and on the table there was a bucket of champagne, and a plate of salmon and asparagus, and a basket of soft hot rolls, and a chocolate cake for dessert, compliments of the hotel, with apologies for the mugging. San Francisco was a genial town, mostly, and this rarely happened. Should he need medical attention, they had a doctor on retainer, etc. Please tell us if there is anything more we can do.
Lotto fell to, and she watched.
He could manage only a few bites before queasiness set in. Then he stood, although his feet felt as if they had been lopped off by an axe, and he tottered to the bathroom and put his clothes and shoes directly in the trash can and took a long, hot bath, watching the tendrils of blood eke out of his wounds. He had lost or was in the process of losing all 10 toenails. He put cold water on his face and arms, which were blistered with sun. He stood up, feeling new in his body, and with his wife's tweezers, he plucked the long, fine hairs on his earlobes and massaged his wife's expensive lotion deep into the skin of his forehead, willing the lines away. When he came out, Mathilde was still awake, staring at the book in her hands. She put it down, tucked her glasses atop her head, frowned at him.
"If it helps, I won't be able to walk tomorrow," he said.
"Then you get to spend the day in bed with me," she said. "So you win. No matter what, you win. It all works out for you in the end. Always. Someone or something's looking out for you. It's maddening."
"Were you hoping it wouldn't work out for me? That I'd get hit by a truck?" he said, crawling under the sheets and resting his head on her stomach. It gurgled gently. The rest of the cake was gone from the tray. She sighed.
"No, idiot. I just wanted to scare you for a few hours. The moderator stayed in his office all night because we were sure someone would bring you to him. Which is what a sane person would have done, Lotto. Not walk all the way back to San Francisco, you crazed maniac. I just called him to tell him you'd showed up. He was still there. He'd freaked his shit completely. He thought you'd been abducted by a band of wild feminists for a videotaped scapegoating. He'd been going over castration scenarios in his head." Lancelot imagined a machete swinging, shuddered. "Eh," she said. "It all fizzed out by the time the lunch rolled around. Apparently last year's Nobel laureate was found today to have plagiarized half of his speech, and there was a huge free-for-all on social media. I looked up and saw full tables gaping at their smartphones. You, my love, were today's small fry." He felt cheated. He should have been even more inflammatory. Glutton. He stewed until he slept, and she watched him for a while, turning things over in her head, and when she fell asleep, she did so without switching off the light.
8. Ice in the Bones, 2013. Dean of Students' Office of an All-Boys Boarding School. On the wall, a poster of a waterfall at sunset with Endurance, sans serif, underneath. dean of students, man with eyebrows that take up half his face. Ollie, skinny boy, recently fatherless, exiled from home for juvenile delinquency. Southern accent he tries to swallow, face full of pustules. Still, sharp-eyed, notices everything. From Act One. Dean.
It has been reported that you, Oliver, do not seem to be fitting in. You have no friends. Your nickname, peers at an index card, blinks. Is Bumblefuck Pie?
Ollie.
Apparently, sir.
Dean.
Oliver, you're making a difficult transition.
Ollie.
Yes, sir.
Dean.
Your grades couldn't be better, but you don't speak in class. Don't call me sir. Our boys here are intellectually curious, vital citizens of the world. Are you an intellectually curious, vital citizen of the world?
Ollie.
Nope.
Dean.
Why not?
Ollie.
I'm unhappy.
Dean.
Who could be unhappy here? That's nuts.
Ollie.
I'm cold.
Dean.
Physically or spiritually?
Ollie.
Both, sir.
Dean.
Why are you crying?
Ollie.
Struggles. Says nothing.
Dean.
Opens his drawer. Under a spill of papers is something that Ollie sees, and he sits up as if goosed. The dean shuts the drawer, lifting out a rubber band, tenting it back with his thumb. He aims it at Ollie's nose and lets fly. Ollie blinks. The dean sits back in his chair.
Dean.
An undepressed person would have avoided that.
Ollie.
Probably.
Dean.
You, my friend, are a whiner.
Ollie.
Dean.
Ha! You look like Rudolph the Red-Nosed La-Di-Da.
Ollie.
Dean.
Ha ha.
Ollie.
Dean, if I may ask a question, why do you have a gun in your desk?
Dean.
Gun? No gun. That's crazy. You don't know what you're talking about.
Sits back, puts his arms behind his head.
Anyway, listen to me, Oliver. I've been doing this for a billion years. I was a boy like you once at the school. Even I was picked on, believe it or not. And I don't see why you're being shat on. You seem to have everything. Wealthy, tall. You'd be good-looking if you washed your face once or twice, Christ. Little acne cream and you'd be strapping. You seem nice, smart. You don't stink, not like one of those hopeless loser kids. You know Jelly Roll? Just irredeemable. He smells bad and cries all the time, foul to look at. Even his little friends, all the Dungeons and Dragons kids, even they only barely tolerate Jelly Roll to make up their bridge parties or something. You? You could be the king of this school. But you're not, because one, you're new, which will burn off in time. Numero dos, you're scared, which you have to change. Fast. Because kids who go to schools like this one are sharks, my friend. They're baby sharks bred out of a long line of sharks, every one of them. And sharks can smell the blood in the water from miles away. And the blood in the water to these particular sharks? Fear. They smell that blood in the water, they're going to hunt the bleeder down. Not their fault. They can't help it. What kind of shark is a shark that doesn't attack? A dolphin. Who needs dolphins? Dolphins are delicious. They make great snacks. So you listen carefully to what I'm about to say. You need to learn to be a shark. Punch someone in the schnoz. Just don't break it. Don't want to be sued by these kids' daddies. Play a prank. Cellophane the toilet so when they piss, the piss bounces on their jeans. Ha! If someone throws a hard-boiled egg in your face, throw a steak in his. Because this is like prison. Only the strong survive. You gotta earn your respect. Gotta do what you gotta do. You hearing me? Capiche?
Ollie.
Capiche.
Dean.
All right, Oliver. What kind of a name is Oliver, anyway? Kind of a dolphin kind of name, if you ask me. Pussy name.
You a pussy?
Ollie.
No.
But I like them.
Dean. Ha! You're getting it. What did they call you at home?
Ollie.
Ollie. Dean. Ollie. You see, there we go. Ollie's a shark name. King Shark. Next time someone calls you Bumblefuck Pie, you get all up in their facha. Make them call you Ollie. You hear me?
Ollie.
Loud and clear.
Dean.
Do you feel your teeth sharpening? Smell the blood in the water? Do you feel like a shark?
Ollie.
Maybe. Or like a dolphin with a razor blade on his fin.
Dean.
It's a start. Go slay them, Slayer.
Ollie.
Slay.
Check.
Dean. Not literally, of course. God, could you imagine? The Dean told me to kill them all. I meant figuratively. Don't slay anyone. You didn't hear that from me.
Ollie.
Of course.
Goodbye, sir.
Exits.
Dean,
alone, takes the gun hurriedly from his drawer, inserts it under the couch. Telegony, 2013. Masks, magic, Circe and Penelope and Odysseus and patricide and incest, music and film and dance. You crazy-ass man, Mathilde said.
Gesamtkunstwerk, Lotto said. Melding all the forms of art as theater. Now we just have to find someone nuts enough to put it on, he said.
Don't worry, Mathilde said. Everyone we know is nuts.
Ship of Fools, 2014. Act 1, Scene 1. Post-nuclear wasteland. Whale belly up in the red tide. Two women among the rubble. Pete. Wiry, small, skinny, furry. A chimp woman. Miranda. Enormously fat. 3 vertical feet of red hair with a scorched bluebird's nest atop it, a la Madame du Barry. Swinging in a hammock between 2 blackened and skeletal palms. Pete. Dragging a dead gator into camp.
Gator tail for supper this evening, Miranda.
Miranda, vaguely.
Lovely. It's just that, well, I was hoping, well, for some whale steaks. If it were only possible to get whale steaks. I mean, don't worry too much about it, but it's the only thing in the world I could possibly digest tonight. But I can get down a little gator, if I must.
Pete picks up hacksaw, sets off, returns wet, chunk of meat in her arms.
Gator tail and whale steaks for supper, Miranda.
Miranda.
What a surprise! Pete, you can do anything. Speaking of which, while you're up, mind pouring me another cocktail? It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Pete.
Reckon not. No such thing as time anymore.
Pours kerosene out of a drum, stirs it with a peppermint stick kept for the purpose, hands it over.
Miranda.
Wonderful. Now,
I think it must be time for my soap. The stars in your eyes?
Pete.
Time's dead, Miranda mine. Television's dead. Electricity's dead. Actors dead, too, I warned, in that H-bomb blast over L.A. Or the Black Tongue Plague after. Or the earthquake. The human experiment done bust.
Miranda.
Then just kill me, Petey. Just kill me dead. No use in living. Just take that hacksaw and chop off my head.
Weeps into her great pale hands.
Pete.
Sighs. Picks up kelp, places it on her head, sucks in cheeks like Sylvia Starr, heroine of the eponymous soap, The Stars in Your Eyes, and speaks in a gravelly voice.
Oh, whatever are we going to do with that dastardly dastard Burton Bailey?
Miranda sinks back, gaping. They are both so entranced, they don't hear the mechanical whirring that grows until, stage right, a battered boat hull looms into view, and survivors peer at the women from above. Rachel was agitatedly pacing the black box theater, empty save for her brother, as the opening night reception thudded behind the door.
Cripes, Lotto! I didn't even know how to watch that, she said, digging her palms into her eyes.
He went still.
I'm sorry, he said.
Don't get me wrong, there's part of me that kind of savagely delighted in watching Mova and Sally duke it out at the end of the world. Sally scraping and bowing until she finally snaps, you know?
Rachel laughed, then pivoted toward him.
You're so good at fooling us, aren't you? You're so charming you make us forget that you have to be a serial killer on the inside to do what you do to us. Put us in your plays, warts and all, showing us off like we're some sort of sideshow freaks. The audience out there just kind of laps it up.
He was shocked cold. Rachel, of all people, turning on him. But no, she wasn't. She wouldn't. Now she was standing on her tiptoes to touch his cheek. In such light, his baby sister's eyes were framed in fine wrinkles. Oh, for the god of love, where did time go? Clockwise swirl going nowhere.
At least he wrote a better version of Antoinette. At least by the end she puts herself in front of the beast for her kids. Praise the Lord, she said in Sally's voice, making twinkle fingers in the air.
They laughed. But in a drawer in Florida, half written, a note. Darling, I have never seen a play of yours in the flesh, as you know, a great sorrow of my life. But I read them all. I've seen the ones on DVDs and online. It goes without saying how proud of you I am. Of course, I'm not surprised. I took such great care from the day you were born to mold you into the artist you are. But how, Lancelot? How dare you? The Bats, 2014.
It's great, Mathilde said. But Lotto detected something in her voice that he wasn't ready for, and he said,
It hurt my feelings at that symposium when they all implied I was a misogynist. You know I love women.
I know, she said. You love them almost too much.
Still, the coolness in her voice, the way she was avoiding looking at him. Something was wrong.
I think Livy came off pretty well. I hope you don't mind that I used you as a model for her character.
Well, Livy is a murderer, Mathilde said flatly.
I meant that I just used your personality.
A murderer's personality, she said. My husband of more than 20 years says I have a murderer's personality. Okay.
My love, he said, don't get hysterical.
Hysterical? Lotto, please, do you know the root of that word?
Hystera. Womb. You basically just called me a sissy, crying because of her pink parts.
What is wrong with you? You're freaking out.
She spoke to the dog.
He gave my personality to a murderer, and he's asking why I'm freaking out.
Hey, look at me. You're being ridiculous, and not because you have woman parts. Livy found herself cornered by two bad dudes, and she killed one. If some big, mean dog bit God in half, you'd kick its brains out. Who knows you better than I know you? You're a saint, but even saints have their breaking points. Do I think that you'd ever kill someone? I do not. But if we hypothetically had a kid, and some man was hypothetically putting his Mr. Winky somewhere near our hypothetical kid with bad intent, you would, without hesitation, rip his throat out with your fingernails. I would too. It doesn't mean you're any less than good.
Oh my God. We are discussing the fact you wrote me into a murderer, and out of nowhere, here you are again with the kid nonsense.
Nonsense?
Mathilde? Why are you breathing like that? Mathilde, where are you going?
Okay, fine. Lock yourself in the bathroom. I'm sorry I hurt your feelings. Can you please talk to me? I'm just going to sit right here. I'm going to wear you down with my devotion. I'm sorry that we got sidetracked.
Can we talk about the play? Other than the fact that I gave your personality to a murderer, what did you think?
It feels a little wonky in the fourth act, like a table with one wobbly leg. Needs some rethinking.
Maybe you can try your hand?
Oh, a bath? In the middle of the day?
Okay, do whatever you need to do.
That feels nice, I bet. All warm, Lavender. Wow, you're going for it. Can we talk through the door? Overall, the piece is really solid, I think. Yes? Mathilde, don't be like this. This is really important to me. Oh, fine, be that way. I'm going downstairs to watch a movie, and you are welcome to join me if you like.
Eschatology, 2014. Only when they came to a stop in the drive, the bourbon-pickled guests already leaping out, and Lotto saw the skateboard broken on a stump, the clumps of wet kid bathing suits on the grass, God so exhausted she couldn't pick up her head, did Lotto realize that perhaps he had not thought this through. Oh dear. Mathilde had been left alone to take care of Rachel's three children since before breakfast, when Lotto went out to fetch milk at the grocery store, but then got a call in the aisle that he was wanted immediately in the city for a last-minute hour-long interview on a radio program. The end of his victory lap for eschatology, which even Phoebe Delmar loved. Though, as he said to Mathilde, praise from a hack is worse than a pan. It was important, so he drove swiftly into the city, sat in his pajama pants being personable for the airwaves, and then set out to drive home with the morning still bright in his eyes. But he ran into Samuel and Arnie laughing together on the sidewalk, and geez, it had been so long. Of course, they had lunch together. Of course, lunch extended into drinks, and Samuel saw a man from his club at the bar, who joined them, some radiologist or oncologist or something, and when they grew hungry at dinner time, Lotto suggested they come home because, as everyone knew, Mathilde cooked like a goddess and he was drunk, but not so drunk he couldn't drive. He sniffed the milk that had been rolling around on the floor since morning. Maybe it would still do. He came in to find Samuel Pepe Le Pewing kisses up Mathilde's arms, Arnie searching through the liquor cabinet for the grand old Armagnac he'd given them for Christmas, the doctor doing a spoon airplane to deliver peas into Lotto's younger niece's mouth, who was wary of airplane spoons. He kissed Mathilde, rescuing her. She smiled tightly. "Where are the twins?" he said. She said, "Passed out in the only place in the house they agreed to sleep. Your studio." Her smile maybe had some spite in it. And he said, "Mathilde, nobody's allowed to go up there but me. It's my workspace." And she shot him a look so sharp it went all the way through him, and he nodded, contrite, picked the little girl up, helped her with bedtime necessaries and double time, and came back down. The guests were sitting on the terrace, getting blotto. The moon had risen sharp against the velvety blue. Mathilde was pulsing herbs in the Cuisinart, pasta on boil. "Sorry," he said into her ear. Then he took her lobe between his teeth. Oh, delicious. Maybe they had time, maybe she'd. But she bumped him back, and he went outside, and presently the four men were in their skivvies in the pool, floating on their backs, laughing, and Mathilde was coming out to the table, a huge white bowl between her hands, trailing steam. "This is," Samuel said, through a mouthful of pasta, dripping all over the flagstones, "the most fun I've had since I got divorced." He looked glossy, a little fat at the waist, like an otter. So did Arnie, for that matter, but of course he would, now that he was a big-time restaurateur. His sun-ravaged back was spotted darkly. Lotto wanted to warn him about skin cancer, but Arnie had so many girlfriends, surely one of them already had. "Poor Alicia. What is this, your third divorce?" Mathilde said. "Third strike, Sam. You're out." The other men laughed, and Lotto said, "Better nickname than the one he had in his early 20s. Remember? One Ball Sam." Samuel shrugged, imperturbable. That same old self-confidence still spun in him. The doctor looked at him with interest. "One Ball Sam?" he said. "Testicular cancer," Samuel said. "Didn't matter in the end. One ball made four kids." "I have two beautiful balls," Lotto said, "that have made zero." Mathilde sat silently while the others gabbed on, then gathered up her plate and went inside. Lotto told a story about the overdose of a very famous actress, all the while smelling some kind of berry cobbler baking, and he waited and waited, but Mathilde didn't come out. At last he went in to check on his wife.
She was in the kitchen, back turned toward the veranda door, not doing the dishes, listening. Oh, that tiny cocked ear, the white blonde hair brushing her shoulder. The radio was on, comfortingly low. He listened also, and heard with a little pulse in the gut a familiar voice, something with the drawn-out vowels of a storyteller, and the pulse turned into a flap of dismay when he understood that the voice was his. It was the radio show from this morning. Which part? He could barely remember. Oh, yes. A story from his lonely Florida childhood. His own broadcast voice went uncomfortably intimate. There'd been a swamp he'd go down to in the middle of a sinkhole. One day, a leech stuck to his leg. And he'd been a boy so terribly hungry for companionship that he left it there to suck his blood, walked home and ate supper, and the whole time took comfort in his companion against his skin. When he turned over in the night and exploded the thing, there was so much blood that he felt as guilty as if he'd murdered a person. The hostess laughed, but it was a half-shocked laugh. Mathilde's hand went out and clicked the radio off hard. "M?" he said. She took a breath, and he watched her ribcage compress as she let it out. "Not your story," she said. She turned around. She was not smiling. "Of course it was," he said. "I remember it vividly." He did. He could feel the hot mud on his legs, the horror dissolving to a kind of tenderness when he found the small black leech on his skin. "Nope," she said, and took the ice cream out of the freezer, the cobbler out of the oven, the bowls and spoons outside. As he ate, a slow, bad feeling spread up from his gut. He called for a car to take the other men back. By the time it drove off, he knew Mathilde was right. He came into the bathroom in the middle of Mathilde's ablutions and sat on the side of the tub. "I'm so sorry," he said. She shrugged, spat foam into the sink. "To be fair, it was a leech," he said. "A story about a leech." She rubbed lotion on her hands, one, the other, looking at him in the mirror, and said, "My loneliness, not yours. You've always had friends. It's not that you stole my story, it's that you stole my friend." And she laughed at herself. But when he came into bed, her light was out, and she was on her side. And though he put his hand on her hip, then between her legs, and kissed her neck, and whispered, "What's yours is mine, and what's mine is yours." She was already sleeping, or worse, she was pretending to be asleep. The Sirens, unfinished. Too much pain. It would kill her. Mathilde put the manuscript in the archival box without reading it, and the movers carried it away. 9. Scene. A gallery. Cavernous, shadowy, gilded birch trees foresting the walls. Tristan und Isolde on the sound system. Piratical crowd drinking from the bars in all four corners of the room, all bloodlust and hunger. Sculptures on plinths uplit in blue. Large, amorphous, molded steel forms that resolve into terrified faces, titled The End. The gallery, the art, brings to mind Dürer's woodcuts of the apocalypse. The artist was Natalie. She was posthumously celebrated. A photo of her was blown up, pale, buzzcut, triumphant over the scene. Two bartenders during a lull. One young, one middle-aged, both handsome. Middle-aged. "Telling you, these days I swear by juice. Kale, carrot, and ginger." Young. "Who's that? Tall man just came in with a scarf." "Oh, my stars." Middle-aged, smiling. "That? Lancelot Satterwhite. You know who he is." Young. "The playwright? Oh, my God. I have to meet him. Maybe he'll give me a role. Never know. Oh, man.
He kind of sucks up all the light in the room, am I right?
Middle-aged. You should have seen him when he was young. Demigod. At least he thought so.
Young. You know him? Let me touch your arm.
Middle-aged. He was my understudy one summer, years ago. Shakespeare in the park. We were Ferdinand. My language, heavens, I am the best of them that speak this speech, etc. Though I always thought of him more as a Falstaff than anything. So gabby, arrogant as hell. He never made a go of the acting thing, though. There was something just, I don't know, unconvincing about him. Also, he was far too tall, and then he got fat, and then skinny again, apparently. It was kind of pitiful. Though, I mean, he did fine in the end. Sometimes I wonder if I should have taken a separate path, you know? If I got stuck, my moderate success propelling me moderately, all that. Better to flame out, try something new. I don't know. You're not listening.
Young. Sorry, I'm just... Look at his wife. She's stunning.
Middle-aged. Her? She's bloodless, all bones. I think she's hideous. But if you want to meet Lotto, you got to go through her.
Young.
Huh.
I think she's unbelievably beautiful.
Is he... faithful?
Middle-aged.
Two camps on that one. Hard to tell. He'll flirt until you're a blob of goo and make you fall in love, then look all befuddled when you come onto him. Happened to all of us.
Young.
To you?
Middle-aged.
Sure.
They look at the frog-like man who has sidled up, who is now listening, the ice in his glass clicking.
Charlie.
You, boy. Need you to do a piece of work. Easy $100. What do you say?
Young.
Depends on what it is, sir.
Charlie.
You need to accidentally spill a glass of red wine on Satterwhite's wife. All over that white dress. Really get it in there. Bonus is, while you're at it, you'll get close enough to Satterwhite to slip a note in his pocket. See where it takes you. Maybe he'll call you for an audition or something. You in?
Young.
500.
Charlie.
2. There are 7 other bartenders in the room.
Young.
Done. Let me borrow your pen.
He takes Charlie's fountain pen, scribbles on a napkin, tucks it into his pocket. Looks at the pen, tucks it in too.
This is so awful.
He laughs, puts wine on a tray, speeds off.
Middle-aged.
What are that kid's chances of scoring with Lancelot, I wonder?
Charlie.
Less than 0. Lotto's as straight as a stick and sickeningly monogamous, too. But it's fun to watch.
Laughs.
Middle-aged.
What are you up to, Charlie?
Charlie.
Why are you talking to me? You don't know me.
Middle-aged.
I do, actually. I used to go to the Satterwhite's parties in the 90s. We've had some conversations in our time.
Charlie.
Oh. Well, everybody went to those.
There is a shattering of glass, and the crowd sound hushes briefly.
Middle-aged.
Mathilde took that gracefully. Of course she did. Ice queen. Off to the bathroom with salt and seltzer. And you're right. Everybody went to those parties. And everybody wondered why you were Lancelot's best friend. Brought nothing to the table, really, did you? Someone pleasant.
Charlie.
Well, I've known Lotto the longest, you know, all the way from when he was the skinny Florida cracker with a serious zit problem. Who would have thought? These days he's famous and I own a helicopter. But I can see that you've really come into your own with this mixology pursuit of yours. So, you know, congratulations.
Middle-aged.
I...
Charlie.
Anyway, glad we got all caught up, blah blah. I have something to do.
Moves off toward the center of the room, where Young is dabbing at Lancelot's pants with a paper napkin.
Lancelot.
No, buddy, I'm serious. I don't believe you got any wine on my pants, but thank you. No, please stop. Please. Stop. Stop.
Young.
Tell your wife how sorry I am, Mr. Satterwhite. Please send me the bill.
Ario. Nonsense, nonsense. I will replace the dress. Back to your station.